I've been captivated by a conversation on Ezra Klein's New York Times podcast this week. The episode is a conversation with Dan Savage. Klein quotes a profile from Slate magazine about Savage that says his column, Savage Love, which he's been writing for 30 years, is, quote, the most important text on contemporary American sexual ethics. Especially important is the way his voice has become a bridge between queer communities and straight communities at a time of great change across the board for relationships. The title of the episode is Dan Savage on Polyamory, Chosen Family, and Better Sex. Many things captivated me as I listened, and perhaps the most important is how, as the hour-long conversation goes on, a subtle shift happens. The conversation becomes not about sex, but about conversation and how crucial communication is to good relationships. Here, Dan Savage suggests a reason why queer people have been such good teachers in this regard. When straight people hook up, he says, there's such a culturally strong assumption of what to do that many don't even talk about it. Not so with queer people. Savage laughed at how often when exploring intimacy with a gay partner, they've simultaneously said, what are you into? And then laughed and said, jinx. Historically, for various reasons, Christians denigrated sex, the body, and frankly, anything outside the bounds of a narrow, procreative, heteronormative vision of sexuality. Peter Brown, years ago, wrote a magisterial book called The Body and Society, Men, Women, and Sexual Renunciation in Early Christianity, showing that this pattern of rejecting body and sexuality started early in the church. Yet it was never the whole story for Christianity. And one of the challenges of our age in terms of Christian sexual ethics is to recover a fresh sense of the goodness of the body, of sexuality. And apropos of the podcast, a fresh accounting of consent at the center of conversations about what is right and good, sexually speaking. Catholic feminist ethicist Margaret Farley made conversation about consent a key in her book on Christian sexual ethics titled Just Love. You might be wondering, and rightly so, if I just liked the podcast and wanted to talk about it, as it seems so unrelated to the text from Matthew about baptism. Yeah, and here the art history is helpful. There's an aspect of this scene in Matthew chapter 3 that I personally have never heard discussed. These representative depictions of the history of art of Jesus' baptism, one from the Winchester Psalter from the 12th century in England, and the other from the Italian artist Barozzino in the 14th century Italy, both very clearly show Jesus totally naked, with the waist-high water in each used as an excuse for the absence of an obvious penis in the full Monty depictions. It turns out that for centuries, early Christian baptisms were likewise done in the nude. Early Christian communities were well known for rejecting the hierarchies and dualisms that structured the surrounding culture, practices summarized in St. Paul's claim that in Christ, and by that he means as baptized into Christ, there is no longer male or female, no longer slave nor free, no longer Jew nor Greek. And this baptismal moment is, in the New Testament, often depicted as a birth, a new creation, in which we are claimed as co-conspirators in God's work of righteousness and peace in the world. To be naked then, and to hear as Jesus did those powerful words from heaven, this is my beloved, my child, in whom I am well pleased, could be seen as the most radical form of affirmation of yourself, body and soul, separate from all the ways that we try to dress ourselves up for acceptance or affirmation. Here at our most vulnerable, our most human, a literal flow of blessing and affirmation pours over us, claiming us for good. Shame about ourselves, about our bodies, about our desires, plays a significant role in bad communication, leading to relationship troubles of all sorts. That we wouldn't judge our bodies, our desires, as valid and worthy of sharing with loved ones within beloved community is one of the most damaging legacies of the Christian tradition. And here at the heart of the gospel story is a possible source of healing for that shame. This passage is the first time Jesus speaks in the Gospel of Matthew, and only one of two places in the whole gospel in which God speaks. It's a pinnacle moment, something that is designed by Matthew to help us know from the start of his gospel who exactly Jesus is, and by association, who we are as those who are united with his life through baptism. Many years ago, the Lutheran feminist theologian Elisabeth Bettenhausen taught me about the interconnectedness of eros, that force of affection and embodied love present in the care of a parent for a child, in the affection of friends for one another, in the wonder of lovers in ecstasy, that the Christian tradition reduced eros to sex and made it bad, she suggests, is our original sin. We have called evil what God has called good. It's a small thing, but I think real and powerful, that we have in the script at St. Lydia's the little instruction about communicating consent regarding the passing of the peace at the end of the service. It is, if you will, a place where we say to each other, you, body and soul, are beloved, and as a sign of respect for you, I honor you, and ask how you desire to receive the peace, a hug, a handshake, a bow, a fist bump. We practice here who we are, beloved of God, and called to fullness of life with God and each other.